Welcome to Purdue Crop Chat, a regular podcast from Hoosier Ag Today and the Purdue University Extension Service, featuring Purdue Extension soybean specialist Dr. Sean Castile and Extension corn specialist Dr. Dan Quinn. On this episode, Sean and Dan discuss the quick, dry harvest, and the guys are getting ready for Halloween.
If I don't get a picture on Halloween of you being a cannibalizing corn stalk, I am going to be very disappointing, Dan.
Corn stalking sweet corn, is that what we're doing?
Yes, I think it'd be fantastic.
This podcast is made possible by the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Your Indiana corn and soybean checkoff investments yesterday are paying off today. New research, new uses, demand creation, bringing dollars back to the farm. Check it out at yourcheckoff.org. Now your host for Purdue Crop Chat, Hoosier Ag Today's Eric Pfeiffer.
Thanks for joining us on the Purdue Crop Chat. We're here at the Indiana Corn and Soybean Innovation Center in West Lafayette. And thanks to our sponsors, the folks with Indiana Corn and Soy. Eric Pfeiffer here with Dan Corn Quinn to my left. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Eric.
And soybean Sean Castile to my right. Hello, Sean.
Howdy, Eric.
We are here after, it's been a while since we've been together. Things have been a bit busy, I think, for all of us. What you guys have been, in hibernation, right? That's what you guys do during this time of year?
That's right. It's already been winter, right?
Yeah. It's been a busy harvest time. And I don't know that anybody's really had much time to do anything but get out and, you know, harvest. I think it's been a lot of long days, long nights, and meals in the combine, and on my way here today out to Acre here at the farm, let's see, I didn't see any soybeans still up. Those are gone now.
Yep.
Those are out. I saw one cornfield still standing on my way in. The edges were off, but it still got some corn there. And then I think Dan just being lazy out here, right in front.
Yes.
There's still one cornfield here at the Purdue farm that's still up.
You're
going to get that here soon,
yeah,
right?
You know the way us university faculty work, right? It's 9 to 5, and you know when 5 o'clock hits, we got to pull out of the field. So yeah, we'll get to it.
I think it's just lawn ornament, right? Just decoration, yes, for the lawn, yes, right?
That for Halloween,
yes. Or deer. It could be, yes, deer, right? You're doing food plot, yes, out there, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe it's part of, you know, if you ever go to Menards, I always laugh at this. You know, they have like the corn stalks for sale, and you know that's what it actually factors out to for a farmer. You know, it's about $60 a bushel, so, or you know, per acre. So maybe
that's why at 5 o'clock you switch hats, and then you've got the, yes, rack wagon out there selling, yes, it. So I,
yes,
got it.
Yes.
I think Purdue just launched an investigation. I think yeah, HR just, yep, started. Is he, yep, selling our corn out there?
Yep,
don't worry, they're getting their 56% overhead from it, right?
But it has been kind of a crazy month here for all of us, just trying to get things together here. And really, you know, harvest is just about wrapped up. Monday numbers from USDA show, 87% mm-hmm, done on soybeans across the state, 77% mm-hmm, done with corn. What part of the state are we still waiting to get done here? Because I think, I mean, for the, yeah, most part, everybody's just about done.
Yeah, on soybean, probably mainly double crop.
That's kind of what
that
I figured.
Late planted would be the main thing.
Yeah, and for corn, what are we waiting on here, Dan?
It's, you know, just, I think, sprinkled here and there. And even, you know, we harvested our plots in southern Indiana, southeast Indiana. Still a fair amount of corn standing, and you think about actually planting. Southeast Indiana was probably one of our later planting down there. And in areas that, you know, actually had a little bit more moisture, you think about parts of southern Indiana did caught much more of a brunt of the hurricane, mm-hmm, that came through. So corn was a little bit more moisture down there. Still good harvest down there, good conditions. But actually, you know, still fields as we got down, you know, that Jennings County area at our southeast farm, still some fields standing. So I think it's, you know, just kind of pockets here and there, and, you know, areas that maybe had a little bit more moisture, maybe we're planting a little bit later. But the majority of folks you talk to are either done or are pretty close to being done. Yeah.
So let's just give it a recap here, Sean. You got done first, so we'll start with you. You've had more time to
plant
think
first,
about this.
I harvest first. I mean, I go fishing first. Oh, sorry, I didn't say about that one.
How did things go? Were there, yep, any big issues here this year? As we, you know, I as I look to a year ago when we were having this conversation, we were talking about some disease that came in late, and we were kind of wrestling with that a little bit.
Sure.
Not really the case this year, right? It was just too darn dry for any of that.
Yeah, that's the key. I think it's just the dryness, right? Early on in September to October, is we were starting to harvest, and things were, again, starting off really well. But we'd already had a handful of weeks without any rain, so I was talking then about sprinkles being taken off the cake. And I think there's actually a lot of cake that doesn't have much of an icing because there's so much of that water was not there for seed fill. So we definitely had some shortfalls there.
Which, at that point, is it even really cake? I mean, because the icing is the only good part of the cake.
There you go. There you go. You're right. Well, you might have to drizzle something through there to get it to soak through.
Yeah. Maybe that'd be like a Jell-O cake. I mean, you got to have something.
A little poke cake. There you go.
A little poke and pour. That's good stuff.
Now, harvest definitely fast on the soybean front and able to get out there. There's many mornings that, I mean, you're hard-pressed in a lot of years to get going before 10, 11. I mean, guys are rolling. There's so little humidity and how dry. Mm-hmm. It's 9 o'clock. People are rolling, and that's unheard of. So Dan can do the 9 to 5 on the corn harvest. Soybeans, it's usually, okay, about noon to midnight, mm-hmm. if we're lucky, right? We can get mm-hmm. that. But, I mean, we had amazing harvest conditions, but the sore part of that is seed fill was limited on a lot of these fields, so I think yield potential was dropped down. The other side of it is we sell soybeans at 13% grain moisture, or if we're cutting at 10-9%, we still sell it at that. And so, unfortunately, I think that was probably one of the biggest things for us, is that we had a lot of fields that are getting cut at 9%, 10%. And if you look at that just on, let's say, a 70-ish bushel type field at 13%, well, you've lost about 3 bushels in just water weight. And so I think we've got a lot of those fields this year, unfortunately, that we had that occur.
And it begs the question, is that going to take us below? I mean, we were predicting the last time we did this, and again, let's remind folks, it has been a little while. Is that going to take us below that statewide average that we were talking about being a record the last time we did this? I'm guessing your answer is yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think you put both of those things together, that we did not have the water for the last bit of pod retention and seed fill. So a lot of these beans were more BBs. They did not get the seed size to them. And then you throw insult to injury on harvesting at 9-10%. You're just taking off 3 bushels straight out of the gate on grain moisture. So I think definitely both of those together at state level. I don't see us being a record yield. I see us being a respectable one. I think if you go back to look at the USDA numbers in early October, and again, those are dated if you really think about it, was pegging us about 60 bushel. So I think we might be hard pressed when it's all said and done to still see that 60 number when it's final.
When you look at Indiana soybeans and what happened there, we weren't the only ones dry. Can you expound on, can we take that to Ohio, Illinois, and across maybe into Iowa and some of the we weren't the only ones hit with this dry stretch. What can that do to the national soybean picture as well?
I think I would echo my comments from Indiana to Illinois and maybe a little bit further west. And when we go east, Ohio, our friends over in Ohio, they took it on the chin a lot earlier, a lot longer. Not just, okay, it's a little dry during seed fill, we're going to lose a few bushels. They were drought status. I mean, you look up and you look at it, is it yellow, is it orange, is it red? Red being the worst. I mean, it was red highlighted in Ohio. And so I think they really took it on the chin with the drought status. And then with the remnants of the hurricane that came through Helene, you had a lot of rainfall down in that part of Ohio. And so they had, I mean, it wasn't even an insult. It was just straight kick you in the shorts kind of deal, that you have all that rain. Now you have pods that are busting open. You have precocious germination, all of it. So, I mean, our friends over in Ohio took it on the chin.
Maybe a topic for another podcast. Get one of our economist friends in here about what it does to the national market picture here. We've seen the markets kind of jump back and forth, and what it does here from a demand standpoint. But a lot of different things going into that picture right now, and You know, just what will those final yields look like? It's going to be an interesting picture when it all comes out in the wash, I think.
There's another thing as I think back on this harvest season that there are areas of Indiana and outside of Indiana that very dry. We talked about that. And the crops started shutting down earlier. And so if we looked at the fields that had the droughtiest spots, like we got some sand ridges, we got some other spots that are just gravelly, those areas actually seem to have some other issues. So they're shutting down earlier. So seed fill, all that coming in that I've already mentioned. But then we had a little bit of these pockets of rain that came through. Dan and I have made this comment, like, where'd this rain come from? Like, it went from Lake Michigan straight south. I mean, there was no west to east, it was straight south two or three times. And so there's pockets up in the northwest part of Indiana that caught that. And so we had a lot of soybean fields that had pockets of, you know, Darcy and I put an article out on this of black soybeans. I mean, the leaves were hanging on. They had a black color to them. Like when you cut them, I mean, black dust. So that was saprophytic fungi. So it wasn't anything that caused the beans to shut down. It's just now you had all that rain for that fungi to grow on it. And so it is a mess in some of those fields.
Before we turn to corn, and you were going to get a similar story here, there's a very important question I have to ask, and I've heard it both ways. Is it droughty or is it droughty? This is a very important question that I need the answer to.
I go droughty with the T.
I was going to say droughty. Yeah.
Have you both heard this? Have you heard people say droughty? Yeah.
I've heard it. But
and you've heard it and you've thought, that's wrong, right?
I'm not going to call anyone out on that.
Come on, Sean. You have heard that and you've thought, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, they where are they from?
That's what I'm saying. I've always thought this is like,
okay, but what do you call that right there in front of you? What do you call that? Do you call that a soda or a pop or a Coke? What do you call it?
Sody pop.
Sody pop.
No,
okay.
I don't. I call it a pop. Come on.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
No, but see, I lived in Pennsylvania for a very short time, and they all call it soda.
Uh-huh.
You go up to Minnesota, it's soda. but I call it a pop, but droughty, I've never.
In the South, it's Coke.
Yeah.
Whether it's Coke or not, it's Coke.
Yeah, it's Coke. Yeah, even if it's Pepsi. We don't have either of them as sponsors of this, so we can drop those names. It's no big deal.
Future sponsor coming.
Which also, by the way, I did not, I feel like I'm stealing now. I didn't buy it. I bought the water, and it came out. So Dan is recommending I buy a lottery ticket today. It's my lucky day. So,
sounds good.
Or maybe I return
you're
it to Purdue.
You're talking to us. It is a lucky day.
Yeah. Yep. Easy now. Easy.
Doesn't say good or bad luck.
Dan, corn. It's, I imagine, a similar story. It got so dry.
Yep.
So dry.
Yeah. Similar story. And Sean mentioned 9% beans and the issue that comes with that. And I would say on having those issues in corn is pretty rare that happens.
Yeah, you guys got this window. I don't know. Oh, we can pull out there 20% moisture.
Yep, exactly.
If someone wants to dry it down, boy, if we get 14.8 on the beans, I ain't going to take it. Yep. Don't get me going on that one.
Yeah, so a lot of farmers, 25%, they'll start harvesting. But, very different this year. Actually had some phone calls where farmers were getting into 12, 13% corn, right? And you start thinking about, and their question to me was, does the same thing for corn track with soybeans, right? Losing the water weight, and it does, right? So that's something that a lot of farmers are not used to with having moistures that low. But you look at harvest progress, it's just same thing as soybeans. It's just been very quick. We haven't really had a rain day to even catch a breath out there. You just keep going and going. Looking at the USDA, I think we're at 77% harvested in corn. That's what, 19 percentage points above the 5-year average, 5 percentage points above last year. I had a farmer the other day tell me this is the fastest they've been in since the mid-90s in terms of their harvest progress. I think US-wide it's the fastest progress since the drought of 2012. So things have moved right along. Yields are all over the board. Some really outstanding yields out there. Some areas that kind of got hit, the old tar spot, the T word, I'll say again. Tar spot did rear its ugly head in certain areas. What was pretty surprising to us is it was in areas that, you know, normally didn't have it and haven't had a history of it. So I think, you know, some of those farmers just, you know, maybe weren't used to washing for it, hadn't had to watch for it in the past. Certain areas that just really hammered that corn crop. And I was talking to Darcy earlier today and, you know, hearing reports of 60, 70, 80 bushels less than what they would expect in that field because of the tar spot. So the tar spot was pretty heavy in certain areas. I think that took you know, some of that yield numbers on the chin and a lot lower. Yeah.
I mean, at this point, Darcy has confirmed tar spot in all 92 Indiana counties.
Yes.
So aren't we to the point where, hey, farmers, you got to be on the lookout for tar spot, and we've got to be managing for tar spot.
Yes.
Whether you've seen it in a field before or not.
Yeah, and it's
you got to be there.
Became very apparent this year, and even in our own research trials, right? We had a lot of research trials that we, you know, do fungicide, you know, comparisons and areas. Even here in West Lafayette, and even our farm South Lafayette was really bad with tar spot. And you know, we're seeing just looking at preliminary data, 20, 30 bushel responses to that. You know, just single fungicide application and controlling some of that disease, but it was all tied back to tar spot. And a lot of our research and a lot of those farmers' fields that really got hit pretty hard. So I think that you had the combination of, you know, certain areas, a lot of areas of the state, you know, Darcy confirming it in all 92 counties. So you had a lot of areas where that disease is working on shutting that crop down. Then you had the combination, it gets super hot and dry as well. And then that adds on to shutting that crop down. So I think kind of like what Sean talked about, I do think we lost some kernel weight, you know, some kernel size in certain areas from that corn crop, probably highly dependent on when they planted and when that crop is actually reaching maturity and how much they lost.
So with that shutdown, both in tar spot and in droughty conditions.
Droughty.
You got a little whispery sound to that, right? You know, Halloween's coming up. Maybe you do a spooky nature. I can't even try it. So was there any concern with cannibalizing stock integrity, right? You know, the favorite test that I love to do is just to go out in a cornfield and just push it down, right?
Yep.
Now, never mind, I'm fertilizing the corn late in the season to find a spot. But, I mean, was that any issues?
Yes.
Also a good Halloween term, cannibalizing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had reports of both lodging and actually stock rots. Okay. So, you know, combination of when that crop really shuts down really quickly. I always say corn's sole goal in life is to fill ears, and it'll do everything in its power and even cannibalize itself to fill those ears. And when that happens, it loses a lot of its green leaf area to be able to pull from. It's going to start pulling from that lower portion of the stalk. When that happens, you know, you're going to have a lot weaker stalk. You can actually split the stalks, and it's basically hollowed out in those areas. Flip side of that too is when that happens, it also increases the susceptibility to some of these stalk rots out in those fields. So you have that combination of both stalk rot and the hollowed out stalk and have some lodging. We were harvesting down in southeast Indiana on Monday and last week in areas where that hurricane came through, that they had, you know, 3-4 inches of rain, high winds. There's a lot of lodging in those areas. And then, you know, different reports of people doing those push tests, and they really fell pretty easy. So that was another challenge for harvest. But I wouldn't say, you know, very widespread. There's a lot of areas that, you know, they planted timely, that crop hit maturity in a timely fashion, you know, and then it matured from there. So it probably wasn't losing a lot of that weight and size.
What I dare say that even if that was occurring, time in this harvest season was on the farmer's side. Even those nasty fields, it's like you're able to get them out, right? Yes. They're not sitting for weeks on end having a wet weather event come through and wind. It's 80 degrees, it's 70 degrees, sunny, and everyone's able to roll. So it's not sitting there to allow more time for it to lodge and break down too, I'm sure.
Correct. And that's, you know, similar thing we're seeing. You know, Darcy and I are working on this new big mycotoxin, you know, project, and you know, have a year like this and very little mycotoxins out there. You think,
which
about,
is good news,
good
just
news
not
for farmers,
for, just not you know, for your research. You know, I mean, it's a little tough.
The researchers and the pathologists, they, you know, they don't like that. But you know, for the farmer, that's a great thing. You know, you think about the rapidness of harvest, how dry that grain is. when harvest is delayed, the moisture stays high, we have cool conditions, rainfall, these issues, that's when a lot of those challenges start to pop up on us, and we just haven't had it. And Sean's right, you just kept going, you just kept harvesting.
There was just no time for it to fall over, basically,
you know,
right?
You know, we didn't have, you know, where you had to stop, and then we have a storm come through and wind, and you're worried about corn falling over. It's just, you just kept going, and the weather was good, it was dry, it was sunny. So it's been a very rapid harvest progress. Yields are, you know, I've been in some outstanding yielding fields. I've been in some that are average, and then some areas, like I talked about, that hit pretty hard with tar spot that are pretty disappointing. So it's kind of all over the board. I think the USDA recent report, October, they did drop it below state record. You know, last year state record was 203. I think they're sitting at about 202 now. So like, you know, Sean said, good yields, respectable yields, probably not quite to that state record level, pretty close, knocking on the door. But I think just the conditions, the disease, and then also just the hot, dry conditions shutting that crop down really impacted the final yields.
Yeah, like on the soybean front, I was talking to folks yesterday, and there's fields that went 40 bushel on first crop beans, and there's fields that ran 85, 95 bushel. And so, again, it's about the haves and have-nots. I think, you know, if you had a little bit of more organic matter in one part of the field, you saw the water holding capacity, boy, you saw the yield monitor pop up on that. So I think it is about water at the end of the day. And so that's kind of where our range was. So again, you go 40 to 80, split the difference, you're at 60, and that's where we're at a forecast right now.
Yep. By the way, if I don't get a picture on Halloween of you being a cannibalizing corn stalk, I am going to be very disappointing, Dan.
I can pull that off. I might confuse a lot of people, you know.
I think it would be hilarious.
Corn stalk eating it, sweet corn, is that what we're doing?
Yes. I think it'd be fantastic. No, he needs to eat the field corn.
Okay. Ooh, yeah, that'd be okay. Very good. Yeah. I was giving him something there.
You had some disease issues this year with soybeans as well. Kind of some new disease that popped up here and there.
Yeah.
Not terribly widespread, but something that growers certainly need to keep an eye on here going forward as well.
Yeah, so red crown rot in particular is probably what you're alluding to. And then
yes,
we've got a handful of counties where it's located and identified through, again, Darcy's group, and Illinois's got a few. And it's a disease that's been present down in the southeast for a while. It's prominent in peanuts if you look it up, but again, it's very similar in terms of its leaf symptomology. I was making this comment probably a couple of podcasts ago when we still had leaves out on the field, but it's got that intravenal chlorosis of the leaf, so it looks very much like an SDS, looks like a brown stem rot, and now a third one, red crown rot. So you've got those in the mix that we've got to be aware of, and so hopefully those that had it or at least had those kind of symptomology, they went out, looked at the field, and then looked at the base of the stem to say, hey, do I have this kind of red fruiting structure, that not fruit per se, but it's fungus fruiting, to see if they've got that disease.
Is it possible, with it kind of mirroring some of those other diseases, that folks had it, didn't realize it, thought, it's just something
windshield
else?
Windshield scouting is going to be the curse of this one, right? It's SDS. I mean, I've had it for years. They're like, oh, yeah, I got SDS out there. And before red crown rot really came through, it's like, it could be brown stem rot as well, or it could be both, right? I've seen plenty of fields that I've walked and looked at that have SDS, have brown stem rot, and they've got plants that have both. Like, you split the stem and you look at it, it's got both. And so I dare say that we've got the same thing going on with red crown rot.
So really get out and scout and get out and look at it. And from a management standpoint, what are we looking at? Is it similar to?
They're still learning a lot on this one, how to manage this one. And so rotation certainly comes into the mind. As far as varieties, I'm not aware of anything that's really got a good published data set on, okay, which one has more resistance to that or not. But I think first identifying, do you have it? Rotating out of the soybean, so then you give that inoculum a chance to kind of die down without having a host, is probably your primary at this point.
Let's take a time out here on the Purdue Crop Chat. We've talked about harvest. I want to talk about some of the research you guys have done. I know that Sean has been you know, he's been done with harvest for a little while now. He's been crunching the numbers. Dan,
reports ready.
Yeah, I do. he's already putting together PowerPoint presentations. He'd be ready to give some of those today if I asked him to. But
well, yeah, you're right, and I mean, I got the seed ready to plant, right?
he's all set and ready to go. So, want to just kind of get some things that maybe you gleaned from this harvest season, some things that we learned, and maybe some things we're ready to pass along during this meeting season that's rapidly approaching. We're almost to November here, guys. So we'll take a time out and come back in just a moment here on the Purdue Crop Chat.
I'm Matthew Chapman, and I farm in Henry County, Indiana. Indiana Soybean Alliance and Indiana Corn Marketing Council invest checkoff dollars into building demand for corn and soybeans internationally. I've seen this work firsthand, and it's been eye-opening to see the growth in these markets, which also brings dollars back to our farms. Promoting U.S. corn and soybeans and increasing global demand is critical to the success of farmers right here in Indiana.
This message is brought to you by the Indiana Soybean and Corn Checkoffs.
We are back here on the Purdue Crop Chat. Eric Pfeiffer here, Dan Corn Quinn there, Soybean Sean Castile here. And let's just chat about some things that we learned, other than it went and got real dry on us. Besides that, Sean, some things maybe from some of your research plots that we can take away from a season like this, and we can bring into next season, seasons going forward, some things you plan on putting in some of those PowerPoint presentations to take around the state. I'm starting to travel here in just a couple weeks for meeting season. It's already going to be underway here very, very soon.
It will. You know, it's nice. I haven't crunched all numbers, but certainly have gotten into the mix of doing it. And the lesson that we've talked about for many years on soybeans, we'll have this debate all spring. Which crop do you plant first? I haven't looked at our head-to-head. You know, it'd be fun to look at our head-to-head comparison between corn and soybeans. We both had four planting dates at the same time, right next to each other. So I'd love to look at that. But in just the soybeans alone, I mean, that planting date effect was huge this year, right? You think about when that dry condition came in late. And so if you had a bean that was planted earlier, matured, I mean, those were the ones that were ticking on the 80s, the 90s. And so, I mean, that was very, very common, right? I had April 22nds that were running 85 to 95 bushels. And then, you know, even May 13th were five to 10 bushels less than that. And then if you're at the end of May, beginning of June, well, we were hitting 60 bushel numbers. So, I mean, that was certainly playing out with the way this season went. We continue to look at biologicals that are out on the market. As of right now, again, numbers are early. Hadn't seen anything that played out, but on the biologicals, sulfur was one that on those earlier plantings, the cover crop, we've had a zero rye project we had for a couple of years, to the line again where we had the zero rye that was terminated. Wasn't huge biomass, but 12, 16 inches back in April. Those were still showing the nitrogen deficiencies that we documented a year ago because of that carbon penalty, right? So we've got some carbon that's being introduced in the soil, which is good. We want that build organic matter, but this temporary issue that can occur that we've documented on it is immobilizing, so making sulfur unavailable, and then it cascades to this nitrogen nodulation and fixation issue that we'll have on soybean. So we saw it again this year, and so looking to, okay, if you're into this system, we can manage our way out of it. Our sulfur applications brought us back up to where we needed to be, so I think there are some good opportunities there.
Dan, what about you? Some things that we learned?
Yeah, I kind of alluded to it earlier. I think, you know, the most consistent and best responses we had was fungicide. But we had tar spot everywhere. You know, pretty significant in a lot of our areas, a lot of our trials that we did the disease work on. So just, you know, comparisons, you know, we have a lot of trials where we overlay and have fungicide as part of a bigger study. It's kind of a single treatment, and across the board, that was probably the most consistent. We have a lot of images and disease ratings that just show, you know, it can control the disease. It translated to yield. So that was probably the biggest thing that stands out to us this year. Really kind of makes sense. I think, you know, the planting date, I'll be real curious to, you know, I haven't really dove into the data yet, but you know, just looking at kind of a 10,000 foot view of ours, I think it actually, our earliest planting date was probably a little bit worse than the second planting date with corn. So I think it kind of ramped up and then it kind of dropped.
Again, going back to what we talked about, corn being a diva early on and then in just right conditions during germination.
Yeah, I would say the stuff we planted in April was probably pushing 2 foot shorter than the stuff that was kind of in that earlier.
No, I'm anxious to look at this head-to-head comparison. So,
you know, looking at our data just real quick, we noticed it kind of started low and then it ramped. Mm-hmm. We had outstanding yields with that kind of that first week in May. I think we were in there, you know, pushing 300 bushel up there, and then it tapered off. Late planting date, you know, was a disaster. So don't go though.
We just ran out of juice. We ran out of moisture. Mm-hmm.
So, but I'll be real curious to look at that. You know, Sean mentioned sulfur. We're seeing some, you know, starting to play around a little bit with the cover crop aspect too, with sulfur. I think, you know, we're seeing sulfur deficiencies in corn pop up a little bit earlier when you have something like cereal rye, and even in cases with clovers too, they can impact the N-to-S ratio and cause S deficiency. So saw a little bit of a response with like ammonium thiosulfate, which is, you know, liquid applied with 28 at side dress. I do think that based on some of our other trials, probably that if we went with something like AMS or something in the starter, I do think it was a little bit better because the deficiencies in those trials were showing up earlier before that side dress application. So we had some good responses out of some studies where we put AMS on pre-plant, and I thought that did really well in areas where we've seen, you know, some of those sulfur deficiencies show up. So I'd be curious to start playing around with that and looking at the comparisons of ammonium thiosulfate and AMS and some of these other sources. As well, we're playing around, you know, the biologicals, right? That's always a hot topic. You know, it's always
which ones worked.
It's, you know, hit and miss for us, right? I think, you know, I haven't dove into all the data. You know, here, like West Lafayette, it's so hard for us to get any responses here just with the soil types that we have here. But you know, the data has come in at a lot of the other locations, the more challenging environments. You know, we did a little bit of these N-fixing biologicals in the cover crop system, which is, you know, really challenging, can be really challenging on the nitrogen front. So be real curious to dive into those to see how they work. But, you know, it's a challenge with all these biological products, right? They just, you know, I always say you might see a pulse here and there in some location and some year and some field, right? But then trying to get something that, you know, somewhat of a consistent across the board is really, really challenging. But yeah, they mean the big things for us were, you know, the fungicide is what really stood out to us. And, you know, I think we had 40 to 50 trials this year. So that data is slowly coming in. So we'll see what else stood out to us.
Well, but I mean, all these products, they say if you use this product, there's a 3-bushel advantage here. You use this one, another. Yeah, I mean, we should be at about 500 bushel by now. And what about 120?
160 bushel soybean? Why not?
I mean, if you add all of them together, that's where we should be, right?
And another, I forgot to mention this, was nitrogen timing. So we had a couple of really good studies that we incorporate rate, source, and timing of nitrogen. That split application or an application more towards like V3, kind of that side dress timing, was leaps and bounds ahead of a early pre-plant, you know, urea application. So that really stood out to us. I think with some of the rainfall that we had early on, I do believe we lost some nitrogen predominantly with those studies and treatments that we had the nitrogen out early. I do think the inhibitors, you know, do help. We do see that. Inhibitors, you know, we've been doing a lot of work with them. It's a technology that's been around for a long time. They do work. They do what they're supposed to. Certain inhibitors, right? There's a lot of other products that claim to be inhibitors. I think your nitrogen pyrins, your DCDs, you know, even urease inhibitors in dry conditions do a good job, do work. But that timing aspect, those split applications, that side dress applications really stood out to us and performing really well this year. And I do think we lost some nitrogen from those early applications.
Dan and I have a new study, just kind of a side study really, that we started last year and we're just talking about this morning, and looking at fall timing of sulfur versus spring in the season. And I haven't looked at the data. I know that you mentioned, Dan, that on the corn side you probably didn't see much on the soybean. I'm cautiously optimistic that my fall applications in corn stock ground with then coming into the 24 season, I was able to pull out those And so that's one area that's been really nice to see, is that maybe we have some more options, because I've been pretty much dead on. If you need sulfur on the soybean front, you need it as close to planting as possible. But perhaps maybe now we've got an opportunity that we can withstand some fall application, maybe lose a little bit because sulfate does move, but not as much of an issue as I think about some fall nitrogen applications for corn. But I just share that as there's some promise with this one. I'm looking forward to look at that data.
Yep.
Let's talk about fall nitrogen application for corn, because sounds like maybe you saw some of that happening.
Oh, maybe
yesterday.
Yeah.
When maybe it shouldn't have been happening. This is I think maybe a pet peeve of yours.
Yeah.
And maybe many other agronomists.
Yeah.
Dan, do we need to get you like a couch that you can lay down on and just let your feelings out? This is a safe space, Dan. Yeah. Go ahead.
Daily affirmations with Eric Feisher.
Yeah, you know, this time of year you do see the fall anhydrous going on, and you know, I've made it known on this, even I don't like fall anhydrous. We don't recommend fall anhydrous. I just don't like nitrogen is so environmentally driven. And even something like anhydrous, that is the most stable form of nitrogen, and you can get away with it in a lot of years where you have the right certain moisture conditions. Really, the soil temperature is cooling, and you can get away with it. But it just sits out there, right? And you're exposing it to a long period of time with environmental conditions. And we see the environment, right? It warms up and it cools off, and it warms up, and you know, you're just leaving it out there to get lost. So, you know, I'm not going to say where or when or who, but you know, did see fall anhydrous getting applied yesterday. It was dry as can be. It was 83 degrees out. You know, so I understand why certain farmers do it from a logistics standpoint, and you're getting it out there, you're getting your nitrogen there, you're having it for next year. But man, you just think about how dry it is, you know, how much, you know, all those slots closing, how much are we losing? You know, the soil temps are not, you know, 50 degrees and decreasing, right? So how much are we going to end up losing if we do end up getting a lot of moisture and rainfall? So it's, you know, it's a really risky move. It's something we don't recommend. It's something I don't like. But I understand why people do it out there. But yeah, did see some of that, you know, kind of a little bit concerning seeing that. But
the checklist, really, though, I mean, if you do fall anhydrous, temperatures 50 degrees, soil temperatures soil at 50 degrees and decreasing forecast, decent soil moisture, so those seed slots, the slots can close.
Yeah.
I mean, those are kind of the turnkey things that you want to make sure of if you do
it,
right?
Yeah. Typically, you know, if you're going to do it, we're typically at Indianapolis and above, right? Moving north, you want to see, you know, having some moisture in there so you can get the slots to close from the shanks. And then also that soil temperature is kind of at that 50 degree mark and decreasing.
Right. So you don't have this turnover, right?
Correct. Yep. So that's the challenge with nitrogen. When you have these ebbs and flows of soil temperature and moisture, you know, it becomes nitrate, it starts moving. You know, if you think about volatility as well with really dry conditions, you're just losing it, right? You paid a lot of money to have that nitrogen fertilizer out there. You're going to be losing a lot of it when you do some of these practices. So that's a big reason why, you know, we don't like it. And then you throw, this is another talk for another day, you know, you talk about the environmental aspects to it too. So
ideally, when do you want it put on? How do you want it, like, in a perfect world, Dan?
Perfect world.
How do you want it done?
Perfect world. I'm always a big proponent of having some through the planter. I do think there's always a benefit to having some at planting, whether it be, you know, right before, you know, in terms of a broadcast application or an application through the planter, right, starter applications, and then coming back at that side dress timing. It's just corn, you know, just doesn't use much nitrogen up until about, you know, anywhere from V4 to V6, and then it ramps up and it starts taking a lot of nitrogen. There's benefits to having nitrogen out there, available nitrogen out there, when that plant is germinating and when that plant that's making that root transition where it needs to access that. But you know, I like reducing risk. I like having it as close to the point in time when that corn plant's really going to need it out there, reducing as much exposure to the environment that we can have. And we saw that with our trials. It was clear as day that those split applications or a little bit more in-season applications just outperformed the earlier spring applications this year.
Sean, what about you? Were you looking to next year? what do we need to do to replace some of the nutrients in here? We've got to get some things back in the soil, right? We did have some good years here of yields. Yep. We've got to get some things back in the soil.
Yeah, I'll go and answer the question. I do not want any fall nitrogen ahead of soybeans. Okay, so that one's good, right? I don't have to address that one. But in seriousness, nutrient replacement is huge, right? We want to have fields that are up to snuff in terms of the ability to provide what's needed. And so I think one thing to bring up in particular with this year in soil sampling, how dry it's been, there probably will be some potential issues with potassium numbers. A lot of soil testing analyses, when the soil is dry, like bone dry, like it has been, they can cause some issues with what those potassium numbers are going to come back at. So just be aware of that. I also want to bring up, this is more of a philosophical kind of discussion, and it's an interesting one, right? I go back to yield monitors, and yield maps are great. We got beans that are running 9%, and I dare say most of us don't do any level of correction for that on a yield map. And what I mean by that is, okay, if those were 70 bushel, 75 bushel beans at 13%, but then now they're 65 to 69, 68, whatever, on the dry side, do we do any correction for that? Because a lot of people are going to go and do nutrient replacement based on yield levels. Well, okay, 3 bushels less may not seem like enough to make a difference, but if you do that 2 or 3 years in a row, you know, does that eventually start to say, okay, we are shortchanging our fields with replacement? So I don't have the answer to that. It's just something to consider, I guess, as we manage fields based on yield maps. In terms of what to do this year, I think we've got to bring the economics into it. I think that we do have soil test levels that are, here's our critical levels to maintain. You know, are you going to build up and maintain approach? I think this maintaining makes a lot of sense, especially with these prices where they're at. So I think you've got to put that in context. Do you have fields that are above critical levels historically based on soil samples you've taken every 2 or 3 or 4 years? And to balance that, right? Okay, we got 10-ish dollar beans. I don't even know if we're hitting $4 corn anymore. Yeah, so I mean, so that's got to be put in this context of making that decision.
With the economics of it, doesn't it kind of start with that soil sample? And now you're saying that the soil sample results might be a little skewed. Doesn't that make it little bit more difficult?
It certainly does. So that's where taking the sample, whatever your approach, you know, I know a lot of people that take every 2 years on the field, others are 3 to 4 years. So having that history really helps you and say, okay, here's where it has been traditionally when I've sampled every 2 years. And yeah, we're hovering around there. We've had outstanding yields for 2 or 3 years, and has the number changed a lot or a little? So then you can kind of balance, okay, yep, I took them this fall of 24, and the potassium numbers just look off to me. Let me go back in the fall of 22 if I happen to, or maybe you happen to do it every year. Fall of 23 was kind of moist, so shouldn't have had that issue, right?
Now, what about the folks that maybe only do it every 4 years?
That's where the struggle.
And maybe that is the case for many. Yep. I honestly don't know.
Yep.
I don't know that I've ever asked a farmer, how often do you soil sample? You guys might have a more realistic view of how often they actually do it. I don't know.
There's a pretty good blend of those that do it every 2 years. I think there's a blend of folks that do 3 to 4 years and they do replacement. Right? They say, okay, here's what my yields were. Here's where they were, the soil test levels 3 to 4 years ago. I know I'm maintaining based on replacement. Here's how much nutrients getting taken off based on these yield levels, and go from there.
Yeah, it's going to be an I think there are a lot of tough decisions to be made. Mm-hmm. And again, if that data is
potentially, I want that to be heard, right? It's not guaranteed, but take it with a grain of salt and do that comparison to, what was it the last time I sampled? And let's be mindful, was that last time you sampled 3 years ago in the fall or 3 years ago in the spring? Because that the time of the year actually has an impact on it as well. Because you think about that corn crop that's breaking down, and then you've got a flush of rain that just brings all that potassium out of the stover. Great. Yeah. But if you don't, that also has an impact, right? I talk dry soil, but you talk about the dry stover itself, it's not being leached out into the soil. So you've got to have that in the context too.
And I'm guessing that a lot of this comes down to whoever it is you work with as well to collect the soil sample. There's got to be a lot of trust there
Yeah, as well. They certainly need to put that in context.
What else here, guys? Again, it's been a short harvest season, but I imagine it's felt pretty darn long, given the long days, the long nights, and everything else.
Sure.
I mean, what else? We've covered a lot here today.
I think as far as this season and this harvest season, these fields should be prepped quite well for the 2025 season. What I mean by that is, we probably shouldn't have any fields that have had rut damage that we have to worry about. Right? If you're a farmer that does any kind of tillage, we probably should have had some really good conditions for fracturing that and moving forward.
Yeah, Dan?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about some of the negatives of, you know, the moisture and stuff like that. But I do think, you know, a lot of folks are saving on propane this year. So that's a big, probably good cost cut this year. And just the timeliness of the harvest, right? It's, you know, being really quick. It allows you, as Sean said, to do a lot of these other things in the fall where other years you just don't have that chance with when you're fighting that rain, you're trying to get that crop out of the ground. You know, we mentioned, you know, just not much issues from, you know, ear rots and mycotoxins and stuff like that. So there, you know, it's still some good things that come out of it. But again, be mindful of the fertility results. And, you know, I did like Sean's point about adjusting for the moisture and the yield. I think a lot of people don't bring that into account.
I mean, it's kind of minor in one way, but boy, if you do that year, most soybean growers, most farmers, I don't see them adjusting the yield map. Yeah. And I get why, because like, well, I didn't get a solid at that. And my grower's like, well, or my landlord's like, well, that doesn't match up with the scale ticket. Mm-hmm. But if you're thinking about using those maps as a management tool, I think you have to think about that adjustment.
You just got to put that in the notes somewhere, like when you're going through it. I mean, is it?
Well, I mean, you can adjust it, right? You can do it on the combine itself. Mm-hmm. You can do it post-harvest and have that adjustment because you got grain moisture. You got those, the grains hitting the impact sensor, right? And so you're creating this. But in that, I mean, it's dry bushels, or you can go through and have an adjusted value, right? When we do research, so Dan mentioned corn being down to 12%. I mean, soybeans, there's not a year that I can think of that I have never had to adjust.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, I'm not padding it. I'm standardizing everything. So when I go in and I harvest a trial, if it happens to start that morning at 14%, and boy, by 2 o'clock, it's down to 11%, that's not exactly fair, right? And so I adjust everything to 13% mathematically, right? And so I'm not putting the water hose in to get that back, right? You know, I think there's some laws on that. But in terms of mathematically, we can adjust it, and you can do the exact same thing with yield maps.
I won't go in and adjust any audio there either. Sure. I'm not one of the big guys that'll go in and adjust audio just how I want to. You know, I won't go about doing that.
We speak truth here. No forked tongue.
We speak truth.
Yeah, and I, you know, just the final point too is at least from the corn size, is just looking at your hybrids, right? That just always stands out to me. Just sheer differences in hybrids. In terms of yield, we had a trial just here in West Lafayette. Had four different hybrids, same company, four different hybrids, and there was probably anywhere from a 30 to 40 bushel difference. Managed the exact same treatments. The management treatments were the same. They're in the same field, replicated in the same field, randomized in the same field. But there's a big difference between the hybrids, and it always stands out to me just how well certain hybrids perform. How kind of maybe mediocre some hybrids perform. There's always just big difference. They could be very similar maturities. They look pretty similar out in the field, but they just may perform, you know, whether it be disease tolerance or differences to management and stuff like that. So, you know, always be, you know, watching different hybrids, trying different hybrids. But then, you know, at this time of year, we always talk about learning from this year. I think the hybrid component is a big piece when you're trying a lot of these out here.
And so they're all meant to kind of work that way, right? Mm-hmm. Like some of them are built to work this way in a you know high management system. Some of them are built to kind of have a high win rate under any type of management system and any type of weather. Like, They're kind of built that way, and
Just always the differences. You know, you look across the field and they look pretty similar, but at the end of the day, when the combine rolls, just those differences and how they pop out can be pretty eye opening.
Yeah. Well, guys, I'm glad you're done, Sean. Get to work, would you? Just go get that field already. Oh, maybe after you go get some lunch.
Get some lunch.
My gosh.
9 to 5. Got Dolly Parton singing in the background.
No, I appreciate you guys coming in today. Get another Purdue Crop Chat done here, and we'll get together again soon. Maybe we won't let as much time lapse before we see each other again.
I think maybe the next one we can really find out which crop you should plant first. That's what I think.
Yeah, let's dig into some of these numbers and bring some of those along next time, huh?
Sounds good.
We'll see who the winner is. Yep. Isn't there a belt? Didn't you guys come up with some sort of belt?
Ohio started State. This, so yeah. we're going to share with Ohio and let them know what's what.
Maybe we can get them in on a Zoom call or something, we can have them FedEx the belt. You guys are going to win, right?
Well, soybeans going to win, and again, unfortunately, Ohio's had some pretty droughty conditions, so I think we would probably win this year.
Yeah, we'll get them to FedEx the belt over here so we can show it off. And. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. We'll do this again soon.
Thank you. Thanks.
This has been Purdue Crop Chat, a regular series featuring Purdue Extension's Dr. Dan Quinn and Dr. Sean Castile, made possible by the Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoffs, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. The Checkoffs are pleased to help bring you agronomy insights from Purdue Extension. Opinions on the podcast are those of the host and guests and not those of the sponsor. Purdue Crop Chat is a service of Purdue University Extension and Hoosier Ag Today. Timely, relevant, credible.